Pardon the interruption. I just want to tell you about a video that I want you to check out. It features the one and only Chuck Norris. You remember Chuck Norris? The man's in his 80s. And, you know, I'm no spring chicken. Nonetheless, I care about my health. I want to live a long time. I want to be healthy. I don't always get as many fruits and vegetables and herbs that are supposed to increase my energy levels in my own diet. So I saw this video that Chuck Norris has made. He's kicking butt. He's working out. He's staying active. He has heaps of energy left over for his grandkids and so on. And he says that he is achieving all this by making one single change. And he feels like he's in his 50s. Go to mymorningkick.com/Josh and watch Chuck Norris's video right now. That's mymorningkick.com/Josh, mymorningkick.com/Josh. Welcome to The Buzz, where we dissect some big scientific issue, especially if it relates to your brain. We try to blow our minds about the nature of our minds with the one and only Professor Joel Pearson, neuroscientist extraordinaire who runs the Future Minds Lab at the University of New South Wales. Joel, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Josh. Good to see you again.
Time we're talking about today, not the actual ticking of the clock, but the way that it...
We might touch on the clock. Yeah,
All right. Let's start with the big stuff then. What is time?
So let's talk about time perception. So chronoperception.
Right.
And so where to start with this? So when we think about the senses, the five senses, we have ears and eyes and things, and we perceive time, but we don't have a sense organs for time. So it seems to be something that the whole brain does. There's no dedicated sense organ. No dedicated brain area.
Like there's not a tiny bit of my brain that's sort of ticking away in the background.
Yeah, there's no like this. These neurons do time perception.
Huh.
It seems to be a nature of the whole brain, and it's also, as we'll get to, affected by what else your brain is processing. So if you're highly stimulated, if you're highly emotionally aroused or scared, all these things will affect time perception. So it seems to be sort of intimately interwoven into what else the brain is doing.
Right.
So it's like double tasking, if you like.
Meaning that so presumably when I'm highly aroused or when my brain is doing a lot of work and I'm thinking very quickly, time seems to take longer?
Normally people report the opposite, that time goes by really quickly.
But what about the effect of I'm in a car accident and everything slows down?
Yeah.
I'm playing a game of tennis and the ball is coming at me slowly.
There's controversy around this. So, because there was some research and people have suggested that it was that time perception as you perceive it is changing in these things. And
right.
Then there was this experiment by David Eagleman where it's a cool experiment. He had people come into the lab, and then he took them all out to an amusement park in the US. And it's one of these rides where they're sort of hanging in a harness and they free fall like 30 meters and they get caught in a net. And they built this rich wristwatch thing where there was these sort of flickering lights. And the idea was that it was just flickering so fast that you couldn't read the numbers. So if your brain speeds up with all the adrenaline while you're falling, all of a sudden you should be able to read the numbers. That little bit of change in brain speed, if you like, should make the numbers readable. You read the numbers while you're falling, bang, good evidence that things change. They did the experiment, no one can read the numbers.
Just as if they were on the ground.
Yeah, it was just the flickering, the lights were there, they couldn't read the numbers. Then they did something where they had people estimate how long they were falling for. And then they had all the participants stand there and watch other people falling and estimate how long they were falling for. And the two estimates were different.
Right. The subjective estimate was longer?
When they estimated their own time that were falling through the air, it was about 36% longer.
Right.
So they concluded that it's not due to perception changing in real time as the thing's happening, but it's due to the richness of the memory, and the memory's laid out differently. And so when we go back and think about things, it's different, right? So if I witness someone else fall, there's no adrenaline, so my memory's just as normal. When I'm in there, my memory's laid down differently. So when we think back to the car accident, the thing, or the hitting the tennis ball, we remember it differently. We think, oh yeah, it was definitely like slow motion. Everything slowed down because my brain was speeding up.
But
the conclusion is that, yeah, it's not. It's just a trick of memory.
Isn't my ability to hit the tennis ball evidence of the fact that something is operating faster in my brain than it would be if I was just looking out the window daydreaming?
Not necessarily faster. And this is where it's evidence that things are happening, that we're living in the past. So we're going to get into this in a second. So your brain's making predictions and it sees the tennis ball or the cricket ball coming, let's say, and it's making a prediction. It doesn't have to wait for it to be here. And then, so you already start moving the racket and it's making that prediction before it happens. So that ties into research where you can manipulate something in the lab and you can have an event that happens sort of first and then an event that happens after it in time. And this event that happens after can change your perception of the event that happened before it.
Do you mean that in the act of hitting the tennis ball, I'm changing my memory of where the ball was a millisecond ago? Or that after the tennis match?
Yeah, so the example I was just talking about was more like a specific setup in the lab where you can have things that happen after an event affect the event, which seems to break physics.
Such as what? What's the kind of
lab? So you can have like a flash and a thing moving on the screen and a flash and another flash. And the second thing, we're talking like 100 milliseconds, will affect the first thing, right?
Which in what way?
It will change where you saw it or when you saw it or change. It'll merge with it. You can do different things.
Can you describe a specific example of an experiment?
There's something called the flash lag illusion where you can have like a rotating thing and a thing will flash and your alignment will get messed up. What's another? There's some other... I can't think the name of them, but there are visual illusions like that where you can have things later in time. Or another example would be if I do this.
He's tapping, for people who are listening to the podcast
and
not watching on YouTube.
And my nose,
tapping foot and nose, right, at the same time.
And we know that the signal from my toe to my brain takes longer than from my nose to my brain.
Right.
But I perceive them perfectly in sync.
Right. But that's because your brain adjusts for the fact that it knows that it takes time.
Yes, but that means there's a buffer in the system, and that's what I'm getting towards.
Ah.
So we're living in the past. And so if things that happen, either they should be happening,
you should feel the nose tap
before,
fractionally before the foot,
and you don't
tap.
And there's
but
other
hang on, isn't it because you know that you're tapping your foot and you can see that you're tapping
other
foot?
People can do it for you.
So if I blindfolded you, and tapped your foot and your nose at the same time, and you didn't know that I was going to do it.
I'm pretty sure,
you would still feel them happen at the same time.
I think so, yeah.
So the nose sensation is being delayed somewhere in your brain.
Everything you experience is actually being delayed in your brain.
Artificially or just because of the time it takes?
No, it's just the way the brain works. It takes, even from your eyes, it takes... let's say 150 milliseconds to 200 milliseconds for the information to be processed, to go back to the LGN, to the visual cortex, and then it bounces up and the information comes back down. So really we're living in the past by a few hundred milliseconds time, right?
But that natural delay should differ between the nose and the toe.
It gets absorbed within that window. If my leg was like 4 meters long, that would take too long, right? It wouldn't have the capacity to absorb that.
So a snake that's very long, if you tap a snake's tail and then snap it, and then tap a snake.
Maybe.
Hopefully not a poisonous snake. Like if it was really long enough to be.
I like it. Yep.
You know, to take a full second or something for the.
Or the longer the snake, the more it lives in the past. Or the longer your leg, the more you live in the past.
In other words, so that's what I mean by the buffer being artificial. Like the buffer is not just an artifact of the fact that it takes time for the sensation to go from your nose to your brain. It's almost like it's being intentionally delayed from your nose in order to account for the possibility that someone's going to tap you on the foot at the same time.
It could be a bit of that. I don't think we know the answer, but that's interesting. But that's not really artificial, though. What do you mean by artificial?
Meaning that your brain is not collecting the information from the nose tap as fast as it possibly could, because if it were, then the nose tap would precede the foot tap.
Right. Yeah. Or there's just a buffer and you have this binding problem. The brain has to figure out which things go together, right? And so it gets more complicated in the actual brain because the parts of my brain which process the color and the movement, one's here, one's here, one's here, they're all in different parts. And so the communication between those takes some time, but you never perceive the color. You rarely perceive the color before you perceive the motion. Now, you can actually set that up in the lab when you have a quickly changing thing. It's alternating. It's doing this and going like red, green, red, green, red, green. To see that perfectly in sync, you actually need to offset. I think you need to, yeah, delay the color ever so slightly.
Oh, is that right?
So you can actually set that up. In other words, for you to see it perfectly, it has to kind of go like red, green. So that you,
not everyone's watching the YouTube, but yeah, if you're listening to the podcast, then you're basically saying that if it, in order, because you perceive motion before you perceive color, you would need to offset the
other color. Way around. No, the color has to lag, I think, the motion.
You see the motion
so
first?
You change the motion and then you've got to change the color a little bit afterwards.
Oh, interesting.
So it's like a misbinding. Because of all this, there's all this stuff's happening at different times in the brain.
Because
brain
neurons are firing around from
different parts of the brain, the back and the front.
It's so amazing that it all just comes in.
It all together.
And we have this experience of being live and seeing things as if they're consistent things across space and time, but actually it's just a jigsaw puzzle that our brain is piecing together.
I mean, the binding problem is a classic conundrum and a classic thing that hasn't fully been solved in neuroscience.
And what's a binding problem?
So binding the shape and the color and the movement all together. So how do I know that the color belongs? So I move my hand. How do I know the color of my hand belongs to the hand and not, why don't I see the blue here in my hand? So how do I bind the color to this shape of the couch? Sorry if you're only listening. How do I bind the flesh color of my hand to my hand? And how does my brain tag all this? How does it know which
signals?
But
why does it need to?
Because it breaks it. Because it's like the Humpty Dumpty problem that's been referred to. Because it breaks it apart and sends it off, ships it off to different parts of the brain, different neurons. And we have good evidence that if you damage one part, then you don't perceive motion anymore. If you damage a different part, you won't perceive color anymore. And then there's a whole lot of other
areas. Right, evidence. I see. So because of different...
The consciousness is happening at different areas.
Right.
But then it's happening here and here. How does my brain then know which bits belong back to... It's got to bring it all back together again.
Right, because your eyes see your hand moving in front of your face and they send the signal to your brain, and then one part of your brain deals with color. Another part of your
brain deals with motion.
And then they all come back together.
So how does it get back together again?
Right.
How does Humpty Dumpty get put back together?
How does it?
So there's different theories. One is like that your brain tags the activity with different frequencies, like 20 hertz or 10 hertz, or like this sort of oscillations of the neural groups of neurons. Another idea is that it all the information goes up this hierarchy to these different areas, and then it has to feed back down to these earlier hub parts of the brain, primary visual cortex, we'll call it, and that up and back down again, and then this hub thing glues it all back together. Or a combination.
That's complicated.
How
do we get AI to know about it? Does that give us any insight into how our brains work when we try to figure out how to teach a computer to know the difference between an object that's moving that retains its color and an object that's moving that changes its color?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because, I mean, the when the big revolutions in AI stuff started happening, people were really trying to model the AI, these neural nets, these learning were based on neurons in the brain. And they're largely still black box systems in that we don't know. It's really hard to look under the hood and see how the AI is learning. But I think we can to a certain degree. So that's an
I mean, it's presumably extrapolating from all of the data that it's ingested, which is presumably part of what we do as well, right? It's like, it reminds me a bit of what's the test with the dummy hand where the people touch the hand that's not actually theirs and it's behind a mirror?
Yeah, so you put your hand in a box. I guess it's not going to work well for just people on audio.
Just describe anyway.
So you put your hand in a box and then you have a mirror and the mirror can make, there's different versions of this. You don't see your own hand and you can put a rubber hand there and you can set it up so the rubber hand, because the mirror looks like it's where your hand is. And then you can do extra things like you stroke the rubber hand and then someone strokes your hand perfectly in sync. And once you start doing that, your brain binds up the visual with the tactile. So it's like, oh shit, this thing, like I can see the brush touching the rubber hand and I'm feeling it. It must be my hand. And then if you like stab the hand or hit it, like you really freak. You think it's your hand being hit with a hammer.
And isn't it also the case?
People really freak out.
But isn't it the case that you can stop stroking the feather on your real hand and continue stroking the rubber hand and you'll keep feeling the feather? I thought that was the punchline to the test.
That. This kind of thing is used as a treatment for people with phantom limb syndrome. So it's people with a missing hand, missing arm. And what will happen sometimes is they'll get the sensation that their hand's in a fist and their nail is like pushing into their hand, and it's quite uncomfortable. It's like they feel like they're making a fist as hard as they possibly can, and it hurts. But there's no hand there they can't do this.
They can't release the fist because they don't have an arm.
But if you do this mirror trick, and when you do it with your other hand or with a fake hand, and then you do this release and you make it look like it should be where the missing hand is, people get relief from this.
Huh.
It's like tricking your brain, and it thinks for a moment that the missing hand is there and it's opening. And that's fascinating thing.
This is why I'm interested in whether or not the eye and toe tapping depends on your seeing the toe tapping, because I can understand that your brain, much as the phantom limb experiment shows, your brain will coordinate the feelings with what it can see is supposed to be happening. But if you were blindfolded and you didn't know, maybe that coordination wouldn't take place and they wouldn't feel like they're exactly the same. Someone needs to do that experiment. You need
it's
to do
probably
that experiment.
Been maybe it's been done. I'll look into it. I'll get back to you.
How much credence do you give on the watch with numbers experiment? That ride, right? The ride where you go up and you go chugga, 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 chugga in a seat up to the top of a tower, and then you get released and you go falling down. It's funny you mentioned that one, because I was doing a podcast for Nova Podcasts a couple of years ago called The Rush, which I think people can still hear, which was 8 episodes about the ways in which our brains get a rush from some extreme activity. So one episode was about sex, one episode was about drugs, one episode was about adrenaline. And for the adrenaline.
And you have to take drugs and have sex.
Well, sadly, I was unable to take recreational drugs for the purposes, but I did go to a Japanese sex dungeon and get strung up by I wasn't engaged in actual sexual activity, but
audio or with visuals?
This was audio, thankfully. Oh, this was an audio podcast. And like a Japanese bondage master, she strung me up in leather straps and hung me up.
Okay.
Yeah, it was amazing. Anyway, one of the experiences that I went through was we rented out Dreamworld on the Gold Coast, which is a big amusement park, for an hour before it opened one day. And we flew up there and they did that ride with me about 10 times in a row.
Yeah.
With just me on the ride. And I was strapped up with a GoPro and strapped up with to see what my physiology was doing in those moments as you're just about to be released, and then what happens when you're dropped. And I remember, I hate those rides. I love roller coasters, but because I love the feeling free fall down. Yeah. I like a roller coaster because I like feeling like I'm a bird, but I don't like my gut just being up in my mouth and feeling like I'm going to puke because I'm just falling. And I certainly don't like the moments before the free fall, where you're just waiting, gazing out over the vista of the Gold Coast, anticipating when it's going to happen, any second now, any second now, any second now. And afterwards, I got down and I said to the operator, it's ingeniously timed how long you have to wait up the top before you get released. It's just long enough that it's uncomfortable. It's just long enough that you really feel antsy and frightened because you expect it's going to happen at any moment. And the operator said, funnily enough, the amount of time that you're waiting at the top is zero.
Well, it goes up and drops.
It goes up and it drops as soon as it touches the top. And all I was feeling was those final moments, maybe a second or a fraction of a second, when it's so slow that you don't have a sensation of motion anymore before it touches the actual top and then releases you down.
Hmm.
So certainly my subjective experience, it wasn't minutes after the thing. It would have been seconds or milliseconds after the drop began, was that the time was interminable. Certainly felt like the time was passing interminably while I was there. I certainly remember thinking, when is it going to happen? When's it going to happen? When's it going
to
happen?
And it's hard to separate memory from the actual thing, right? So how do you know whether, because now all you have is the memory. Right,
but is it the right
test to measure
to say, is it the right test to say, can I read numbers that are flashing very quickly? Why would I necessarily have the ability to do that just because my experience of time has been slowed?
It's you also have to add in that, and it would affect like visual processing in the visual cortex.
Exactly. Right? And that, yeah, that's
so,
and right.
It may not. It may be other parts of the brain, or, you know, so it's only testing one narrow visual perceptual dimension.
Yeah, that's
thing,
it.
Right?
Strikes me as the wrong experiments. Yeah. Now. I mean, you would need to, you'd need to ask me. I suppose you can never do it in real time because everything becomes a memory of the previous millisecond, doesn't it? But you would sort of need to ask me in real time over a headset, like, how long does it feel it's you've been up here? But I
you
guess
could,
I'm still
you could do, no. You can do timing intervals and drop people from different heights and see, like, do that. And so they're actually trying to time it as they're falling, right? And then I guess you compare it to watching other people, a bit like they did, but try and take out the effect of memory.
Yeah.
But it gets tricky, yeah.
And if, and just because I could count 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 1,000 at the same rate when I'm waiting for the drop as I could after the ride, does that mean that the experience is going at the same pace? Because I could still be having the same.
Well, if your brain speeds up or the brain processing changes, then you would be counting differently. And you
well, but again,
notice,
that, but the yeah. assumption there is that my language slows down as well,
yeah.
which is another assumption, like the visual thing. There's something.
It's a hard. I mean, this is a, you know, we get pushed up against this problem all the time, trying to separate the thing from the memory of the thing, and you just have to do it in real time.
Right.
So yeah, the perceptual flicker thing is one way to do it.
Okay, so let's assume that we don't know that time slows down in extreme situations.
It certainly seems, it certainly is different in memory, and there's data from that. And the right. idea, the theory around that is the richer your experience of whatever, on your vacation, your holiday, the more stuff gets pushed into it, your brain thinks, oh, that must have happened, must have been a longer period because there's just more things happening, more stimulation, more different people, more scenes, right? If you're sitting in, you know, a cell for three or four days and nothing happens, then as you look back, it's going to be like, what, it was like a couple of hours or because nothing changes.
Right, but there's it might have felt interminable. It might have felt
at
like
the time,
3 weeks.
And so that's, at the time, it would just drag and drag. But later on, you should get this flip where the great vacation, you know, in memory feels like it was spread out, but at the time it's like, oh, the day's over already, damn.
Yeah, interesting.
Sitting in the cell, it's like every, you look at your watch and you think it's the afternoon and it's like a minute's gone by or something.
And does pain extend time? Do we know? Because, you know, there's like experiments where
there is some new research that came out last year showing that, again, look, this is like really like 100 millisecond times again, really short, which for the brain is actually a long time, that as your heart beats, it affects your time perception.
Ooh.
As the heart contracts, your perception of time actually gets shorter. And then as the heart relaxes, your perceptual, you think time, the same amount of time is longer. So when you have to do these things where they can put these stimuli on sound or visual things and they measure your heart, so they time it, they sync it up. Yeah, and you'll perceive the same thing to be shorter or longer depending if the heart's contracting or releasing.
Does that mean that having a fast heart rate changes your time perception versus a short?
But it seems to be like, slow? So it's both within the contraction and the relaxation.
Right, okay.
So it's boom, boom.
So it's moment by moment. So it's not like
alternating faster and faster as a heart rate.
It's not like
up.
I can just give myself hypertension and therefore experience time differently.
No, but that was interesting because there's a lot of new research linking the heart and breathing and all this stuff we tend to think of as just the body, whatever. It does affect cognition, thinking, time perception.
Mm.
Yeah, so there's more links with that than we originally thought. Yeah.
I remember there being a study about how if the final moments of a painful procedure are not painful, then you'll have a more favorable perception.
Like
I think it was Kahneman who just died. Yeah.
Just died, yeah.
Can you explain that? Do you remember that?
I think it was a colonoscopy study.
Yes,
from
it
memory.
Was.
So, and this, I think it's similar for holidays as well, that these peak experiences will sort of mess with your memory of the whole thing. And let me just remember how the study goes. They actually had participants in a colonoscopy as part of the study. And it's the last like few minutes.
Yeah, I think what they did was, from memory, correct me if I'm wrong, they extended the duration of the unpleasant procedure in order to make the end of it less unpleasant. So they pretended still need to be doing things,
but
those
less
things
painful,
were non-invasive
but
and
the
non-painful.
Low pain goes for longer. That's right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so and people reported subjectively the
afterwards
experience being less painful, even though the peak pain was just as pain. I don't know who's doing these fucking colonoscopies, by the way. They're not supposed to be painful. You're supposed to be sedated.
I think they did the study a while back, and I think in some of his interviews I've heard him say, like, everyone relax. This was done. It's different now.
Right. Now they give you fentanyl.
Like a painful thing.
And morphine. But anyway, so it was supposed to be, it's equally painful, but if you have a pleasant final
couple of minutes,
you remember the thing. In other words, your intuition might be, I just want the painful experience to be as brief as possible.
Yeah.
But actually, you'll remember it as being more painful if that's the case than if it's a longer experience, equally painful, but ending with less, with
if at lower, the end there, there's pain. Less, yeah, you've got to drop, I think you have to drop the pain at the
same
end
thing
there.
With a holiday, which would be,
yeah, I think so, yeah.
At the end, if you have a peak experience at the end of the holiday, you'll remember the whole holiday as being better. And if you have a bad experience at the end of the holiday.
Yeah, the flights on the way home are all messed up and the delays and everything.
Your bag gets lost on the way home. Suddenly the whole holiday gets tainted.
You remember the holiday is like, man, it wasn't very good.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, memory. People think of memory as this like video recording of the whole thing as it happened. And it's not, I mean, you have visual optical illusions. People know about those, but there's effectively illusions in every part of our mind and brain, right? And there's lots in memory. If you have to try and remember a string of numbers, the stuff at the beginning and the end are easy to remember. Everything in the middle is really hard to remember. These peak experiences, so it's not like a video recording of what happens in your life. It's sort of certain things are laid down in memory, and then we sort of try and reboot that memory with these little fragments that are there. And so it falls bias to all these things about the nature of how the brain is processes the information.
And so in terms of time, it certainly strikes me subjectively that the amount of novelty that takes place in an experience affects my memory of how much time it took. In the sense that, to go back to the holiday example, if I'm going on a vacation on a holiday and I'm bouncing around a bunch of different places and having quite varied experiences in each place, then the 2 weeks feels like longer than 2 weeks. And Absolutely. If I'm only staying in one place at one resort.
Funny you should bring this up. Let's try and do a visual demo. We'll try and do it to the camera.
Okay.
And see if you can see it too.
We'll load this in.
But if you can see it.
On the YouTube.
Let's wait for it to just reset. So what it's going to show.
To hear the rest of this conversation, go to uncomfortableconversations.substack.com/listen and you will get your own personal premium podcast feed with at least 3 extra episodes of the podcast every month and heaps of extra stuff, including the remainder right now of the fabulous conversation you've just been hearing. If it was worth listening to this much of, don't rob yourself of the rest. Pull out your phone right now and search for Uncomfortable Conversations on Substack.